David Teckwitz, I'm Morris Nichols, Arshton Tunnel for the Appalese. I would like to introduce my co-counsel, Everett Johnson, Jr. of Latham & Watkins, who will make the argument for the Appalese today with the court's permission.
Welcome to the court. May it please the court, Peter Walsh on behalf of the appellant, Joseph Nemec, who is seated in the courtroom. In terms of my time allotment this morning, I'm going to take about no more than 15 minutes to address the good faith and fair dealing claim. And then Mr. Gallagher is going to spend about 5 minutes addressing the breach of fiduciary duty claim. And then I'll take about 5 minutes for rebuttal. We will rest on our papers for purposes of the unjust enrichment claim. As your honors know, this is an appeal in two separate but consolidated actions. Both complaints share the same core allegations and the same common claims. The Court of Chancery dismissed the good faith and fair dealing claim based on the rationale that the company had a redemption or an option right, and it was free to exercise that right in its discretion and at a time opportune to it. And we respectfully submit that the Chancellor erred in ruling in that way because he failed to recognize that in this case, the redemption was unique from any redemption that had preceded it. In fact, the redemption in this case and the impending Carlyle transaction rendered the officer rights plan essentially obsolete. This is the last redemption that would have occurred under this plan because the company was being acquired. And I think it's important to remember several important fact-based allegations which are pled in the complaint, but which really, I think, illustrate why this is a paradigm case for the application of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Most importantly, the terms of the plan. This plan provided that the company had a redemption right after 2 years or after the retiree had been retired for 2 years, as Mr. Nemec and Mr. Whitkemper had. And what that meant in this case was that prior to March 31st, 2008, the company had no right of redemption. So had the Carlyle deal been approved prior to March 31, 2008, as originally had been anticipated, they would have had an absolute right to participate in the Carlyle deal and as a result receive four times book value. After March 31st, the company's right was entirely discretionary. The terms of the plan provide that the company can redeem any portion of their stock at any time. And what that means in this case is the board did not have to redeem on March 31st. It could have waited a week. It could have waited a month. It could have waited 5 years to see how this all played out. And there isn't any question, based upon the well-pled allegations of the complaint, that as of March 31st, everyone had reason to believe that this deal was going to happen. And there is absolutely no reason why the company could not have waited to see how this played out and allowed Mr. Nemec and Mr. Whitkemper to participate in the extraordinary transaction and benefits that were derived as a result of the Carlyle deal. Now, how did this redemption affect each of the constituencies? And this is really the critical point here. From the company's perspective, remember, the purpose of this plan was to incentivize officers to vest them with an equity interest in this enterprise moving forward. When the company is being sold and the officer shareholders are selling their equity interest, that purpose becomes completely obsolete. So looking at it from the perspective of the company, and this was the defendant's position below, that this was a benefit to the company. It was an option that benefited the company. Well, the company, in fact, did not receive any benefit from the redemption. In fact, all the company did was paid to Mr. Nemec and Mr. Whitkemper the book value, or approximately $15 million for their shares. What benefit did that have to the company? Zero. This was simply became an allocation issue. Which of the stockholders are going to be in at the time the deal closes and which are going to be out? There was no benefit to the company. And certainly there was no benefit to the plaintiffs. Instead of getting $700 per share, they received $162 per share. So clearly, the company didn't benefit from this redemption. The plaintiffs or appellants did not benefit from the redemption. So who did benefit? Who were the winners? Well, the winners was the board, who themselves derived over $6 million as a result of the redemption, and the other stockholders. Now, the board might say, well, what about those other stockholders? Don't they have a right? And our answer to that is, why do they have a greater claim than our clients do to the end value result of the work that all of these people put into creating this enterprise? Mr. Nemec and Mr. Whitkemper had a combined 50 years of service. They were founding fathers of this firm. Why shouldn't they participate?
Mr. Wallace, why wouldn't the other shareholders that you're talking about on your allocation analysis, why wouldn't they say to the board, why aren't you relying on the company's contractual right here to buy these shares at book value now? Because that will increase our allocation accordingly, and that's a responsibility you owe to us as our portion of the shareholders.
Your Honor, and I think in part that's their argument, and our response to that is our clients were owed a responsibility as well by the board. And those other stockholders, again, do they have a greater claim than my clients or our clients do to the end result? Their argument would be, well, gee, you had the opportunity or the discretion to redeem, and you didn't do that, so that wasn't great for me. On the other hand, the board's response would be, well, this is the last redemption that's going to occur under the plan. The purpose of the plan is to benefit and to incentivize those equity holders in going forward. But we're at the end game now. We're at the end game. We're at the point where we sell the company and we all derive great value because of all the hard work we did. And you, Mr. Junior Partner, you would get $100,000, for example, if we redeem Mr. Nemec and Mr. Whitkemper. But why should we do that? Because they, as founding fathers, and having devoted 50 years of their effort, created that value. Why should they participate, or you participate, and not them? And again, Mr. Junior Partner, my answer to them would be, this is discretionary. We have the right under this plan. We don't have an obligation to redeem after 2 years. And that's where the covenant of good faith and fair dealing comes in.
And you mentioned the incentive. How did the incentive work with regard to retired officers? I mean, if you're retired, you know, it would seem the incentives were all done.
I think that's right. And I think for whatever reason, and we don't know the reason, board, which adopted this plan, obviously felt that retirees may continue to contribute value and therefore should be benefited by holding the stock. I think there's probably also an issue of whether the company might not be in a position to redeem at a specific point in time after 2 years, perhaps if there was a cash flow issue or something like that. But I think the intent and what you can glean from the intent is that simply at your retirement doesn't mean that you would not continue to contribute to the company. And, for example, it would not be uncommon, I think, in a business like this that retirees would continue to consult and do things that benefit Booz Allen even in that two-year span after they have retired.
Well, I don't know if there's a factual record on that or not, given the procedural status of this, but if that were to occur, wouldn't they be on a contract basis?
Yes, they
wouldn't be gratuitous contributors.
I don't know. There isn't a record on that, Your Honor. And I believe that, you know, it's possible that existing partners may have some contractual. So I'm not sure that the fact that they may have a consulting contract would necessarily obviate the idea behind allowing them to hold their stock for 2 years.
Well, let me ask you a hypothetical. Let's suppose we had the same timetable. More than 2 years had expired, so it's back to the board's discretion. And in my hypothetical, let's assume the board minutes showed a discussion that said, it looks like the stock is at an all-time low. It's never going to be this low again. It's probably going to go up in the future. We should really exercise our right now and buy the shares when they're at the all-time low. Would there be any problem with that under the covenant of good faith and fair dealing?
Well, again, the reason I think it could be a problem, particularly in this case, is what benefit is that to the company? And here, the situation we have is there's no benefit to the company to redeeming. The only benefit is derived from those who are stockholders at the time the deal happens. So the covenant of good faith and fair dealing exists to preserve the spirit of the contract, as this court said in Dunlap, and we don't know what happened at the board level. The response that we've gotten in response to our breach of fiduciary duty claim is that the redemption decision was delegated to the company.
Does the record reflect, as the Chief Justice said, I know the record's not developed because of the procedural posture, but is there anything in the record to reflect the prior history of redemption with regard to officers? For example, was it routine to redeem the stock generally? Was it routine to do it in 2 months, 3 months, 6 months? Was it routine not to do it at all?
There's nothing in the record, Your Honor. We don't know.
Do we know how many officers were in this, other than these two, historically? Do we know how many officers participated in the plan?
We know that approximately at the time of redemption there was 300, and I think in essence it went from 300 down to 298. But there is nothing in the record regarding the past prior history of redemptions. I can tell you what my clients have told me. I don't know that that's proper, but there is nothing in the record. And similarly, there's nothing in the record to suggest that anybody other than these two gentlemen were similarly situated, in the sense that nobody was redeemed within a few months of Mr. Nemec and Mr. Whitkemper. In fact, they were the only ones who were redeemed at the time when this deal had been publicly announced. It had been negotiated. As we've alleged in the complaint, the board took any number of actions in recognition of the fact that this was not business as usual, and this was the end game for the government business.
Does this record reflect whether there were other officers whose stock was not redeemed? And, you know, so in this group, you mentioned that are many, many other people. Did anybody participate in this merger that had been a prior officer, or was everyone's stock, all former officers' stock redeemed at one time, you know, your clients being the last?
I believe that everybody who was a stockholder at the time the board approved the deal, which was just approximately 6 weeks after the redemption, participated.
But were now, did that include any officers?
Oh, yeah, yes, of course. Almost all the officers are...
The incumbents. I'm not being precise. Any retired officers?
I don't know, Your Honor. That's a good question. I don't think there's anything to that effect in the record. In other words, people who are not currently officers who had retired in previous years. I don't know the answer to that.
Well, the record doesn't show one way or the other.
It does not.
But the record does show that with respect to these two particular individuals, I think one of them or maybe both of them approached the CEO of Booz Allen and in effect raised the question of whether they would be redeemed out before the deal.
Yes. Yes.
The Carlyle deal closed, and as I understand it, it's alleged in the complaint that the CEO said, no, we're not going to do that. This is an easy moral decision.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
And then the company went ahead and did it.
Exactly. And that was, as alleged in the complaint, that was on March 10th. And the significance of that is that the chairman and CEO of this company recognized that there was a redemption decision. It was a significant one. These gentlemen held 3.5% of the stock. It was, to my client, that the difference between book value and the Carlyle deal was $40 million.
But you said the company did it. It's not clear to me in reading the briefs if there ever was a board resolution with respect to your two clients. Is the record clear on that, or is the same person who said this is an easy moral decision the individual that unilaterally said let's redeem it?
The record is not clear because we don't know. And what happened was after the appellants were told they would participate, the next thing they knew, their shares were redeemed, and it was what happened, and the board essentially went mum. So we don't know. What we do know is that and this has been alleged, is normally the board would meet in early March. What the board did was extend its own term by 90 days in recognition of the deal. But we don't know whether there was a board decision. We don't know whether there was a delegation of the redemption responsibility to a subordinate officer. What they've said in their brief, again, this is a motion to dismiss. We have not had discovery. We have not had, because we were not shareholders after the redemption, we did not have the opportunity to make a books and records demand.
Well, what's confusing about following the arguments, not that they're not good arguments, is that on the one hand, the argument is the board did this, and the board has a problem because the board members collectively got an extra $6 million. And so naturally, you would say, well, did the board do this? And that doesn't appear to be clear on the record. And then there's the allegation, well, you know, the head of the company suggested that we would be able to participate, and yet it might have been that same person who made the decision that we wouldn't participate. So that's all unclear, isn't it?
It is unclear. And that's why we have alleged both a good faith and fair dealing claim and a breach of fiduciary duty claim. And part of our fiduciary duty claim says it may have been that there was an improper abdication. The rights plan itself in Delaware law contemplates that the board makes a redemption decision. And if it didn't make a redemption decision in this case, that may in itself be an issue. But just to sum up on our good faith.
I want to ask one thing. If the parties had anticipated this, and I know your argument is that all of this was unanticipated, how could they address this by contract to specifically deal with this situation? Just limit it to your clients or do it in some other fashion?
No, I think it would obviously be difficult to anticipate this. It was not anticipated. But I think what the contract could have said is something to the effect, in the event of an unforeseen circumstances, where there is a windfall or unfairness, the board can consider all the facts and circumstances and act in a reasonable and fair manner to preserve the spirit of the contract. Again, remember, the purpose of this rights plan was to vest equity in those who were contributing value to the enterprise. And our point is, we got to the end of the day, and those who contributed most don't get to participate. And that's why we think this is a paradigm case for the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, because it says that doctrine exists to preserve the spirit of the bargain as opposed to the letter. And what it prevents is arbitrary or unreasonable conduct. Again, we don't know why the company acted as it did. We don't know what the rationale was. But if, for example, the rationale was nothing more than, well, it benefits us to redeem, and even though we don't have an obligation to redeem, we're going to redeem. That is, I believe, a fair statement or appropriate case for application of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
You want to save your last 2 minutes?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank
you. Mr. Gallagher.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Let's assume hypothetically that we were to agree with Mr. Walsh that what occurred here was a violation of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. If that were the conclusion, is there any room for the survival of a fiduciary duty claim?
Your Honor, I think there is. The claim asserted for breach of the implied covenant, which we think is very strong, is asserted against the company. And in this case, we have also asserted a separate claim against the directors, and that is for breach of their fiduciary duties. And there are cases, as the court knows, in which there have been dismissals or dismissals after summary judgment motion of fiduciary duty claims where they stand alongside a claim for breach of the implied covenant. And two of those cases were decided by Your Honor. Those are the Gale and the Madison Realty cases. But in those cases, in Gale, Your Honor allowed an implied covenant. The implied covenant claim in that case was asserted against both the company and the directors. And the court found that the fiduciary claim was essentially identical as against the directors and held it could not.
Isn't that the problem here? Because the fiduciary duty claim, as I understand it, it rests on the manner in which the discretion to redeem or not to redeem was exercised. But the implied covenant claim also, is based on how the redemption decision or the non-redemption decision was exercised. They both have the same basis. So how can both survive? Or to say it differently, if there is a violation of the implied covenant, doesn't that swallow a fiduciary duty claim, at least in this case?
Well, Your Honor, in the end, that may be the case. In the end, we don't seek a double recovery. We don't seek to recover the same damages from the company and also as against the directors. But this is a situation where, as has been indicated in response to earlier questions, where the facts are very much unknown. The directors ordinarily would be expected to participate in redemptions. As we pointed out, the directors are actually liable for improper redemptions under 174 of the
Are you saying that the fiduciary duty claim is a contingent claim? That is, if for some reason the implied covenant claim doesn't survive, then the fiduciary duty claim should?
Your Honor, I wouldn't call it exactly contingent, especially at this stage of the game, but in some ways it could be looked at that way. The truth is we just don't know enough about what the directors did or who actually made this decision. If they made the decision, they made it with a conflict of interest. If they didn't make the decision, they may have delegated it improperly. The other side's position is that the directors delegated this decision to the company, which is a non-person. Ordinarily, that directors delegate to a committee or to specific officers. But here we just don't know what the facts are. And because our clients were not stockholders, they were because they had already been redeemed prior to the completion of the transaction, we don't have access to the documents that were distributed to all of the then stockholders, which explain, if they do explain, how these transactions actually were carried out.
Well, the decision to redeem or not redeem is a decision that has to be made by the board or somebody acting on behalf of the board, isn't
it? That's what we would think, Your Honor.
Okay, so if that's the case, even if the board delegated its responsibility to someone else, does that fact displace or render inapplicable the implied covenant claim?
Your Honor, the board may not have delegated anything at all. The board may have just abdicated. The board may have just not acted, and some...
How could the board...
Your Honor, we don't know, but it's quite possible that some management person made this decision, and it did not involve the board, and it should have involved the board, and the board should have exercised some judgment in how to make the decision. But based on the facts that we have, which are limited in this particular aspect, we just don't know what the board did. And that's why at this early stage, I would suggest that the more recent case we've cited, Schuss and Astro Power, which allowed claims of implied covenant and breach of fiduciary duty to go forward at the same time, at the motion to dismiss stage, that's why I would submit that those cases are instructive as to this point.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Chief Justice Steele. May it please the Court. The plaintiffs in this case suggest that the claim is simply that they would like to be treated equally with all other shareholders of Booz Allen, and that it is inherently unfair for the company not to do so. But if you lift the veil of that claim, what they're really asking is to be treated extraordinarily differently than anyone who has preceded them. They are asking this court, under the auspices of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, to raise your pen and renegotiate the contract that governs this dispute. What they would like you to do is in that provision in paragraph 10 of the stock rights plans, which says that a retired officer has the right to retain his stock for 2 years, they would like you to insert a parenthetical that says, except for Mr. Nemec and Mr. Whitkemper, they have a superior right to the rights of all other retired officers. The covenant of good faith and fair dealing is not to do equity. It's not to restrike the bargain. It's not to make everyone feel better about the outcome of the case. It has a much narrower purpose, and it has no role in this case for two reasons. First of all, the conduct of the parties is governed by express, unambiguous language in a contract. And second, the parties to that contract got 100% of the benefit of their bargain.
Now, under the contract, who could redeem the stock?
Under the contract, the company can redeem the stock.
And how would the company do that? Through the board of directors or through?
Doesn't require board action, Your Honor. I'm outside the record here, but what is in the record is the stock right plans itself, which delegates the redemption right in paragraph 10 to the company, so executives of the company could make that decision without board involvement.
So you're saying when the board approved the contract as approved included the board's delegation of authority?
That's correct, Your Honor. And that's in 1988, rather, and that is in the appendix in this case. Now, the plaintiff's argument around the idea that there is express language here governing this seems to me to sound something like, but it's not fair, that we made an enormous contribution to this company, and because of the way that things played out on the calendar, it feels unfair to them that the express contractual rights were exercised.
Let me interrupt for a moment. Under the contract, the redemption, the payment is made to the retired officers, and the payment comes out of the corporate treasury. Okay. So the company is the one that is the party that is either paying a lot or a little, and you know, if depending upon how the market is, the amount that would be paid out would change, right?
Technically, no, Your Honor, because the amount that's paid. Yes.
Okay, fine. But in this particular circumstance, the money that's being paid out is not actually coming from the company in the sense that all of the money is being paid out now to all of the stockholders. So if the amount paid to these two former officers increases, then the amount paid to the rest of the stockholders decreases, right?
If they had participated in the transaction, that would be true.
Right. So doesn't that make this a somewhat unique situation in the sense that we're not talking about a company that's continuing to do business, and this is one element of its ongoing operations is that we pay off former officers. Instead, we've got a company that is liquidating in the sense that all of the current stockholders are being given their share under this transaction. And the amount is going to depend in part on whether these two former officers get included as continuing stockholders or get excluded and are paid the book value, right?
Oh, that's true. Yes, Ron.
And is it reasonable to say that that's the way this original redemption plan was set up to contemplate this transaction?
Yes.
Where is it that you can glean an expectation that if we're at the end game and it's a matter of days or weeks, too bad for you if you get redeemed two days before everybody else gets a windfall?
In at page A73 in the appendix of this case, in paragraph 14 of the stock rights plan of Booz Allen, the contract specifically deals with the event of a recapitalization, with a liquidation, with a merger in which Booz Allen would be the surviving enterprise, and a merger in which Booz Allen would not be the surviving enterprise. So it is factually incorrect to suggest that the parties to this case did not contemplate a transformative transaction. The contract deals with it. Their grievance is that at the time of the contract, when the express terms were set, it didn't include the provision that they want. It didn't include, if something big is happening and you're close to it, you get to keep your rights. So it wouldn't be correct to say that they didn't contemplate this. It would be correct to say that they didn't bestow this right to them in the bargain.
Would you mind telling me what that paragraph says about what you do in the case of a liquidation or
It talks about the acceleration of stock rights. What happens in the company is, in the event of a liquidation or various kinds of mergers, that there is an acceleration and an immediate vesting of stock rights. That's what happens to the shareholders. What doesn't happen is that your retention rights are altered, that a retired officer, for example, if it was the case that they wanted to bestow this benefit on the plaintiffs or any retired officers in the stock plan, they certainly could have. As they were talking about recapitalization, they could have said, in addition to the acceleration and vesting of stock rights, we shall also cease redemptions. If this is to occur, there shall be no further redemptions. But they didn't say that. It's not that
Did they say the opposite, that there shall be redemptions?
Paragraph 10, which deals with this, simply says that they have the right to hold for 24 months. And after that, it is in the absolute, unconditional discretion of the company to redeem. The company always redeems.
Well, unconditional in the sense that there's no conditioning language, but whenever there's discretion that is expressed in that way, isn't it always an implied term that discretion has to be exercised in good faith?
No, I don't think so, Your
Honor. So the board can act in bad faith?
As this court said in Gilbert versus El Paso, if you are acting pursuant to the express terms of an agreement, your motivation is irrelevant. So if
there are Delaware cases that condition the discretion, at least implicitly, upon its being exercised in good faith.
I think, Your Honor, that it may be that with respect to certain kinds, you're talking about the Chancery Court's decision in Gale versus Burchard, and then the Immersale case by Chancellor Chandler, which has been recently decided after trial. But the court has always said, and the court has never said, let me put it this way, that all exercises of discretion are subject to judicial review. What the court has said is if at the time of formation, a party to the agreement retains the discretion to set the price or to determine whether the conditions have arisen, that determination must be made in good faith.
Well, counsel, there are, you may be right to the extent that the language that creates the discretion says, for example, that the board, you know, after 2 years may, in its discretion, redeem the stock of any retired officer for any reason or no reason. That is, it can explicitly, the parties can contract for an arbitrarily based redemption. But where the contract doesn't say that, there is case law in this jurisdiction that implicitly conditions the exercise on good faith. I just want to understand what your position is.
Our position, Your Honor, is that good faith and fair dealing has a role to play in the exercise of discretion when the discretion is uniquely in the hands of one party to establish the contractual rights. In this case, there's no question about that. And it helps me in my thinking about it to think about it in the following way. All executory contracts have promises that occur in the future, and in that sense, they are all discretionary. For example, if I'm a lender and an event of default occurs, I have the discretion not to declare a default. I don't think the court would say that if I do declare a default under the agreement, that there ought to be judicial review of that exercise of discretion. And this is uniquely problematic in the case of an exercise of an option, because options are the shifting of risks. There is a disappointed party in every option transaction. And if the court were to say that the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, because discretion is inherent in puts and calls in the exercise of options, that the covenant of good faith and fair dealing authorizes judicial review of a party's motivation, then it's fair to say that in every option transaction there could be a litigation, no matter how clear the terms of the option. An example exists in this very case. It's in the record that Mr. Whitkemper tendered approximately 6,000 of his shares during the two-year period. He didn't expect us to say, why are you doing that, or what's your motivation, or how will you use the money? He expected us to say, where should we send the check? He was exercising discretion that he had to put his shares. His motivation in doing so was irrelevant. Those roles reverse at the end of the two-year period of time. Then, under the contract, that discretion vests in Booz Allen. And our motivation in exercising the option at that time is not subject to judicial review. It's no different than any other agreement. It's not different from the loan example that I think illustrates the problem of simply suggesting every time there is discretion that there ought to be judicial review under the covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
But in this case, there's discretion that directly impacts the people who are exercising that discretion because they will either get more or less payout to themselves.
Your Honor, the plaintiff suggests that that's a problem in this case. I suggest to you that's the bargain. That is the deal that was struck. I think, as I understand the plaintiff's argument, they make essentially two. One is that the exercise of discretion, all discretion, no matter what, is reviewable under the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Respectfully, we disagree for the reasons that I just stated. They make a secondary argument. It was at the center of my colleague's presentation, in which he says there was no business purpose for the company in the exercise. And while we disagree that there was no business purpose for the exercise, we would draw the line closer. We would say there doesn't have to be a business purpose for the exercise because the bargain is struck in the express terms of the agreement. The intent of the parties and the benefit of the bargain is reflected in the document.
Why is it your argument a merits argument? I mean, we're dealing with a dismissal of the complaint. Maybe you should win on summary judgment.
Let me say, Your Honor, I think it's inappropriate. I think Chancellor Chandler had this exactly right. Because if there is, by the way, as I understand it, no debate about the express language of this agreement. It is clear that we had a right to redeem. So unless, as a matter of law, the covenant of good faith and fair dealing kicks in for reasons that I don't comprehend, then it absolutely should be dismissed on a motion to dismiss because they are not alleging a violation of the express terms of the agreement. They are suggesting that the court ought to ignore the express terms of the agreement because the covenant of good faith and fair dealing would lead to a different result. Our position is there's no legal way to get there. Gilbert versus El Paso, the express terms control. The covenant of good faith and fair dealing is to fill gaps. It's an interpretive device. It is not a reformative device. It is not a we're unhappy with the deal, we wish we had done it differently, can't we look at it through the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. If I'm correct about that, then you don't need a factual inquiry about good faith or bad faith because you don't get there. You end at the express terms of the agreement. And I think this is important, not just because my clients would like to win the case.
But your argument assumes that this scenario was anticipated.
Well, I don't think it would make a difference if whether or not it was anticipated, but I believe it was for a couple of reasons. One, as I set forth previously, I think any review of the relevant documentation, the very contract in question, anticipates it. Similarly, I don't think one can be a shareholder in a privately held company and not anticipate the possibility that that company might be acquired or go public or engage in some other sort of monetizing event. So I think it's intuitive that it was anticipated, but we don't need to rely on intuition because the document describes the transaction. Even if it was unanticipated, however, I'm not sure how one would get there, but even if it was unanticipated, I don't think you could conclude that the court ought to engage in reformation. And here I'm relying on the court's decision in Dunlop, where the court described, I think, in a very unique public policy context having to do with uninsured motorist insurance, the court described the methodology by which reformation can occur. And the court said in Dunlop, two things must happen. First, something unanticipated must have occurred. For the reasons stated a moment ago, nothing unanticipated occurred here, but hypothetically assume it did.
You're telling us that without the benefit of a factual record, that nothing unanticipated occurred?
I'm saying, Your Honor, that I think you can, from the record in this case, in the appendix at page A73 in paragraph 14 of the very contract in dispute, that you can find that this was anticipated because it's described. But even if it were unanticipated, the second thing you would have to find in order to reform the contract in the way that they straightforwardly request is that you know how the parties would have agreed, that you know what they would have agreed to under those circumstances. And in State Farm, that's where business purpose became relevant. In State Farm, that's where the court looked at State Farm's interest in denial of the claim and said you have none. But it was only in there is no general rule, so far as I can tell, in Delaware that you have to have a business purpose for everything you do. It was the rationale for reforming the contract. It was the reason the court was able to say, we know how you would have agreed because you wouldn't have had a reason to have acted otherwise. In this case, it's not just Mr. Nemec and Mr. Whitcamper who are parties to this contract. All of the shareholders of Booz Allen are parties to this contract. So in order to do what they ask you to do, you would have to conclude that you know, beyond a doubt, how everyone would have agreed to that. We can quarrel about what the negotiation might have been. I submit to you, we know what it was because it's in the agreement. But the idea that all of the other shareholders of Booz Allen would have agreed that Mr. Nemec and Mr. Whitcamper ought to participate is the kind of speculation the court ought not to engage in reforming the agreement. Let me add just one other thought. Counsel argued, I think, eloquently about the contribution that Mr. Nemec and Mr. Whitcamper made to the firm. And this is not a place to disagree with that, and I suspect we wouldn't disagree with that. But they are not alone. All of the partners who preceded them made a significant contribution. I will note the obvious. Mr. Booz and Mr. Allen and Mr. Hamilton did not participate in this transaction. But the line they suggest is unprincipled. Why, for example, would Mr. Nemec and Mr. Whitcamper participate in this transaction when someone who retired a year before them, perhaps making an equal contribution, would have no right to participate? What would be the equity in that? There is no line to be drawn other than the contractual line that was drawn. You get to hold the shares for 24 months, and after 24 months, you no longer have that right. One difficulty that my client would have, Your Honor, in response to your question, is if they permitted Mr. Nemec and Mr. Whitcamper to participate in this transaction, if they did exactly what the plaintiffs in this case say that they were legally bound to do, how would they explain that? What would they say to the current shareholders of the company, and what would they say to the retirees who preceded Mr. Nemec and Mr. Whitcamper? They could, through affection, have bestowed a windfall benefit on Mr. Nemec and Mr. Whitcamper and ignored their contractual rights. But in doing so, they would have ignored their obligations to all others. What they did in this case is they acted consistently and they acted fairly. As Chancellor Chandler said,
of course, we don't really know what was in their minds, do we? I mean, that would be a wonderful post-trial argument, but we're in a motion to dismiss the complaint.
I guess, Your Honor, what I'm suggesting is you don't need to know what's on their mind. And what I was trying to do is suggest that what the plaintiffs want you to do is ignore the express language of the agreement out of a sense of unfairness is both legally wrong because there is express language in the agreement, and their sense of injustice is misplaced because you would simply be shifting that sense of injustice to people other than Mr. Nemec and Mr. Whitcamper, who would be equally aggrieved. Every retired partner of Booz Allen and Hamilton knows what was paid for the share price, and every retired partner of Booz Allen and Hamilton knows how many shares they had, and with a calculator, they can all know what they would have earned if they had been shareholders at the time of the transaction. Mr. Nemec and Mr. Whitcamper are not different in that regard, other than proximity. And as I had previously said before, a person who misses an airplane by 5 minutes is more frustrated than the person who misses an airplane by 5 hours. Neither is entitled to be on the plane. And that's the frustration that you're hearing from them. It's not unfair. It's not unjust. It's not unequal. It's just frustrating. Let me just conclude by saying the covenant of good faith and fair dealing is particularly ill-suited to solving this problem in this case, because there would be no boundary on the principle. It would be that in the exercise of an option, if the court were to announce that in the exercise of an option, the discretion is subject to judicial review under the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, then it would be hard to say what exercise of an express contractual right would not be subject to such review. And as Justice Jacobs wrote in the Gale versus Bouchard case, the primacy of contract is important. Parties need to understand what their rights are, what they can do and what they can't do. And if the covenant of good faith and fair dealing is the hole in the donut through which all claims can be driven, then parties can't understand what their contracts mean, and they can't act in accordance with their rights. Unless the court has further questions, thank you.
Thank you. Just make a couple points. First of all, the appellants are not asking to be treated differently from prior officers. Again, the record doesn't reflect whether the company, in fact, treated prior retirees differently. We don't know whether perhaps the company did, in fact, allow an officer to hold their stock longer than 2 years and not redeem. Certainly, we'll ask that in discovery. Secondly, in no case prior to this redemption was the company being sold to a third party. That's what makes this different. This was the end game. The company, again, derived no benefit whatsoever from redeeming the stock. The only benefit was it reduced the number of stockholders from 300 to 298. It took out 3.5% of the stock, and those who stayed to participate benefited. The company received no benefit. And that, too, is the reason why this is not the typical option contract. This was a redemption decision that was supposed to be made by a board of directors, and a board of directors looking at the equities could conclude that entirely consistent with the terms of the plan, they could have allowed these gentlemen to participate. Mr. Johnson has referenced paragraph 14 of the rights plan, and I think, and I encourage the court to review that, because what it says, in fact, is that in the case of a recapitalization and an officer, a shareholder is holding a right to exercise for stock, he's entitled to exercise before the liquidation or recapitalization occurs. It does not speak in any way, shape, or form to redemptions. This situation was not contemplated by the agreement, and I think it's highly misleading to suggest that paragraph 14 answers the question in this case. Lastly, I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.